This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
Today we have the story of Moshe seeing an Egyptian person hitting a Jewish person. He kills the Egyptian. Two Jews report on him. And Paro is after to kill Moshe. Moshe flees. No women appear in that story, so we won't dwell on it. But in the next story, once again, the women appear. Did you ever think there were so many women in the Torah? Every couple of pages was a whole new parasha, and women are the center of it. And the story, as you know, is that he once again finds himself at a well. Once again, not that he's been there before, but others have been. Why a well? The Midrash says, "Kolat derech avos." He's doing what his forefathers did. Yitzchok found his match at the well. Yaakov found his match at the well. So Moshe had nowhere to go. He went to the well. At the then we're told that the high priest of Midian had seven daughters, and they came to draw water and to fill the troughs to feed the flock of their father. The male shepherds came and chased them away. Moshe got up and saved them and fed their watered their flock. They came to Reuel, their father, so he has more than one name. He's called Reuel here, and he's called Yitro earlier. And he says to them, "Why are you so quick today? How come you've come back so quickly?" And they answer, "Batsamana," this is in chapter 2, verse 19, "Ish Mitzri Hitzilonu Miyad Haroim," an Egyptian man saved us from the shepherds. "The Gam Doloi Dololonu," not only that, but he fed our flock for us. "Vayashkif Atzo," and he gave them to drink. He drew the water and gave them to drink. And you can imagine what kind of work that is, drawing the water for an entire flock, bucket by bucket, and giving them what to then giving them to drink. "Vayomer Rabbeinu Esav," and he says to his daughters, "Va'ayon," where is this man? "Lama ze'azavtem esoish," why did you leave him? "Kirena lo v'yirchalochim," invite him home for a meal. How can a man helps you over there and you just leave him? "Vayor Moshe l'shevet esoish," and Moshe. The word Vayoel is an interesting word, and we'll see in the Medrash how it's taken. But it's like agreed, acquiesced. And according to some, it is he swore that he would dwell with the man. "Vayitein is Tzipora vitol Moshe," and he gave Tzipora his daughter to Moshe. "Batei lirbein vayikrosh mo Gershon," he has a child called Gershom, "ki amar ger ho yisi beretz nochriya," because he said Gershom is from Ger, I was a foreigner in a strange land. And interesting, with Moshe all this time living in Egypt with the entire Jewish nation, does not get married, flees to Midian and marries a Midianite. Of course, converted. Let's look at some of the Medrash on this. The first thing that the Medrash deals with is how is it that Moshe finds himself in the hands not only of a non-Jewish family, but the Kohen Midian, the priest of idolatry. The high priest of idolatry, Yitro was, the master of idolatry there. "V'haloa Kodesh Baruch Hu Sonei Avedas Kechavim," Does God not despise idol worshippers? V'nosan manos l'moshe etzav oved avedus kechovim. And he gives Moshe a place to flee, to be protected among idol worshippers. Elamru Rabbi Seinu, but tradition has it, our rabbis have taught, that there's a bit of background to the story, and we see the background suggested in the verses that we've read. Yisroi komel avedus kechovim hayon. Yisroi was, in fact, the high priest of idolatry in Midian. V'ro'o she'en bo mamash. And he came to the conclusion of his own accord that there's nothing in it, that it's empty, that it's fake. Uvisei oleho v'hiheh la'asas tshuva. And he announced that that's what he discovered and thought about doing tshuva. Ad tshuva bo Moshe. This is before he even met Moshe. On his own he came to this. So similar to the story with the daughter of Paro, Yitro himself had, through his own efforts and with no contact with, through no contact with any Jewish people, come to the conclusion that this wasn't the right thing. Korel ibn Eira, he called his city council, his city elders, and he said, "Ad achshav yisi mishamesh eschem, I've served you well as an idol worshiper and as a priest. Me'atoz v'kenani, I'm very old now. Bachru lachem kemer acher, find yourselves another priest." And so he took all his idols and idolatry related things and gave them to the temple, to the church, whatever. And so he does this in a very diplomatic way, trying to not burn his bridges, kind of. He's old, he's retiring, and he gives them everything. What was their response? Veniduhu. And they ostracized him, they put him, they excommunicated him. Shelo yizdakek lo odom, but nobody was allowed to talk to him. Lo yasu lo melacha, nobody was allowed to work for him. Lo yiru es tzoino, nobody was allowed to tend his flock. Vikesh min aroim liru es tzoino, he tried to hire shepherds to take care of his flock. Lo kiblu, and they wouldn't do so. Where do we see this in the... any of this in the sentences and the verses that we've read? Can you see any of this?
His other name.
What is his other name? And what does that mean? It's a Re'u with an ayin, not with an aleph. Re'u but you're still right. Re'u'el with an aleph would be having seen God, and Re'u'el with an ayin means. What does Re'a mean? V'ahavta l're'acha kamocha. No, that's Yira also with an aleph. Re'a. Re'a is a friend. Friend of God. So his name, his original name Yisro, changes to Reuel, friend of God. So we see that there's been a transition, we see there's been a change in the man. What's interesting is, what is he known as? What does the Torah call him? Yitro. Yitro, probably from something like that, although it wasn't his Hebrew name, it was his Midianite name. So Moshe is known by his Egyptian name, and Yitro is known by his Midianite name. Of course, what would happen if Moshe went to a Jewish school? What would they say? Yeah, so your name is Moshe. Moshe is an Egyptian name. You're not Moshe. You're Chaim Yankel. So you go calling him Moshe. And from then onwards, he would be Chaim Yankel. Every Baal Tshuva, the first thing that happens when he goes to Israel, he comes back name changed. The first thing they do, detach from your history. The Torah, although he became Reuel, keeps on calling him Yisro, because that's his name. That's who he was. That's how he grew up. All you need to know is that he's got another name. I have to call him by his other name. And I'm very disturbed when Baal Teshuva changed their names, because it's a personality change. And Torah is not about changing personalities. Changing Torah is about changing a value system. So you want to take on a new name, you want to add to your name, you want to do whatever you are, but what your parents called you when you were a little baby calling around the house, that's your name until you die. There's no reason to change your name. And it's artificial, it's fake, and it's part of the whole pretense that you've gone through this major. Now I'm not Peter anymore, or Paul, or whatever it is. There's a Baltosis called Peter. There's a Baltosis called Paul. They didn't change their names. They may Rabbeinu Peter. There's a Rabbeinu Paul. These are people that are in Tosis. These are Rishonim. They didn't change their names. The Amoraim have Aramaic names. They didn't change their names. Those are the names they kept. Moshe had an Egyptian name. Yisro had a Midianite name. The Torah calls the Fedra. There's a Fedra called Yisro. The Fedra is not called Reuel. The Fedra is not called Chaim Yankel. The Fedra is called Yisro, because that's who he was. And it's part of the... it's important to notice it, that it's part of the trend of detaching almost from parental connection. that Bali Tshuva go through when they go to yeshiva. Yeah, your parents are nice people and all that, but now you're learning the real thing. And your name, your everything, and your image. And the first thing the Bali Tshuva comes home and tells his parents to start calling him something else. It's very artificial to do that. You call somebody something for 20 years to suddenly change their name into what you call them. And we acknowledge in Hebrew that the name you have is not necessarily the name you're called by. That's why in a ksuda or a get, you'll see long names that aren't used. But people have names. Names is part of who you are, but then there's the name that you're called by. And in fact, when we write a get, when a name is really very, very critical, and the spelling of the name is critical, and everything about the name is critical, and the writing of the get, not only do we use names, we use the nickname. If a person was called Honeybugs, we'll say the Ikri Honeybugs, and we'll write it out in Hebrew, because that's what they were called by. Your name is the way people refer, that's what creates a name. And in fact, if that's how it will be when you write a ksuda. It's not that important. So you ask the girl, what name were you given in shul? When your father named you, what name were you given? But with a get, that's not the important thing. You put that in as well. But the important thing is, what do people call you? What are you known by? That's what the name is. So we see that it's just an interesting thing that, yes, there has been this transition and there has been this tshuva, and Yisro becomes Reuel, but the Torah still calls him Yisro. All the way through, the Torah calls him Yisro, because that's his name. So that's the one place we see it. Where else do we see it? Yes?
In the girls were doing all the hard work?
Yes. The girls were unmarried. The girls were doing the hard work. And the shepherds wouldn't help. If he's the high priest, surely they would help. I mean, he's a VIP, surely he's a celebrity. Surely the young guy, it's an ideal place. The girls come, or the son, the daughters of the celebrity, and they're going to stand and let. It doesn't make any sense that they wouldn't participate, that they wouldn't help if these girls were left on their own. So this is the background which led to the situation. And the girls came, says the Medrash, they used to come very early, the girls, to get there before the shepherds, because they knew the shepherds would molest them. So they used to try and come very early. And the Medrash asks, is it possible that he was the Kohen of Midian and that the shepherds would chase his daughters away? It's teaches you that they ostracized him, excommunicated him, and they rejected his daughters. And now Moshe comes onto the scene. And interestingly, if we do a replay and we say, had he not done Shuvah, had he not rejected idolatry, he still would have been the celebrity. Being the celebrity, the shepherds would have helped the girls, and Moshe would never have met Yisro and would never have married Zipporah. So the whole, what looks like such a calamity in a person's life leads to one chance encounter that leads the whole life off into some different direction. It's impossible to know what is calamity and what isn't. Vayakom Moshe, and then the Medrash says, Moshe, as the Torah says, Moshe got up, Vayoshi'en. The Vayakom Moshe is an interesting word the Medrash plays on. That's in verse 17, in verse Yud Zayin. Vayavor haroim vayigarshum, the shepherds came and they chased him away. And it's interesting, those of you who've got Rashi, you'll see now how difficult it is to understand Rashi if you don't understand the background. Look what Rashi says on they chased him away, they chased them away. Vayigarshum, Rashi just says two things, mitnei hanidus, because of the excommunication. But that's all that we really know. Rashi said a little bit earlier that Firish Lomavid as well, that he stopped serving idolatry, Veniduhu Me'etzlam, and they excommunicated him. But very, very briefly, Rashi makes reference to the Midrashic material. Then it says, Vayakom Moshe Vayoshi. Moshe got up and saved them. Why doesn't it say Vayoshi or Moshe? So Moshe saved them. What is Vayakom? Moshe stood up and saved them. Says the Medrash, Melameid She Yoshov Lohen Bodin. That teaches us that Moshe judged them. I said on a Monday night show recently that we're living in a time in a society where judgmentalism is considered negative. And we said it's not. Judgmentalism is very important. It's very important to judge, not to be judgmental, but to judge. What's the difference between being judgmental and judging? Yes? I don't know about a reduced list. I'm not talking about a correct English usage, but...
Judgment is based on a clear understanding of truth, based on some objective or fixed set of criteria, whereas judgmental... It's much more subjective than it implies that you have a negative that you look down on someone. I mean, you can judge that someone has committed a terrible crime and yet not be so gentle.
Okay, but the difficulty with that is where society is holding at the moment is that all objective criteria are in fact subjective.
Well, that's right.
And therefore, everything is, using that definition, everything is judgmental. So you're just because you happen to believe in the Torah, or you happen to believe in Christianity, or you haven't, that's your thing, and that's everybody's thing, so don't be judgmental. That's the way it's come to be used today. Therefore, there are no standards. But I'm looking for a slightly different nuance in the meaning of a judgmental attitude and judging.
Which is this?
Right. Judgmental, I think, is where you're writing off the person. And again, in last Monday night show, the R-rated one, we looked at how the Torah is careful not to write somebody off because they've done something wrong. You judge an action, and you're entitled to judge an action, and you've got to constantly be doing it. You've got to do it with yourself all the time. You're judging your own actions. You're judging other people's actions. Based on their actions, you're deciding how to relate to them, how to react. You're not judging them. You're not saying they're bad people. Maybe it's because their mother treated them badly when they were 2 years old, and it isn't their fault at all. But you're saying, that's not my issue. I don't want to have anything to do with that person because I don't like their actions. And if they change their actions, that's fine. But while the person is acting in that way, I don't want to be with that person, or I want to be cautious about that person or whatever. So the process of judging is really important, and Vayakum implies judgment. And he judged them. On what basis did he judge them? On the following basis. Derech anoshim doilim, the noshim mashkos. The normal way of the world, so what is he using as his objective standard? Not the Torah. He's using normality. These are Midianites, I can't use the Torah with it. He says, Derech oilim, it's the normal way of the world. That men draw the water and women feed the flock. V'chan noshim doilis, v'anoshim mashkin. And here I see the women drawing the water, and the men are feeding the flock. There's something wrong here. Now, why is that the Derech Olam? What is he talking about? Why is the Derech Olam that the men are in America? This would be unconstitutional, this method, to suggest that men should do this and women. One of our clients has a fire department a woman nearly resigned from the fire department because they talked about firemen. I didn't know that they were called anything. You know that they're not called firemen anymore.
What are they?
Firefighters. Yeah, you're not allowed to call them firemen anymore. You get into trouble if you call them firemen. So the one good reason is hard physical work, which is what one of the Mephoshim say over here, because it's hard to draw physical water, and so it's physically hard to draw the water, so they do it. And it's less dignified because of that, in a sense. Yeah. And so that's for the Sharon. I thought you were like to say something. And there's some things that women do that are very hard work. Harvesting and weeding, there are certain labors that women do that are hard. So I don't think that's what Moshe is getting at. I think Moshe is getting at the very essence of the male and the female ego. Okay, what does the man get his ego from? Wow, this is tough, huh? Getting all this water up. Look, I've done in 1 hour, I've done 55 buckets. How many did you do? I did 65. Wow, okay, I better go and work out. I need to be able to do 65 buckets too. Women aren't like that. That's not what... That's feeding the flock to a little lamb, and look at them, they were so thirsty, and they're all okay now. It was hard work, but it was worth it, because look at them, and I've saved them, and they're okay for another day. The nourishing that the woman gets a sense of fulfillment from the act of nourishing. The man gets a sense of fulfillment from the act of conquest. And drawing the water up is conquest. It's counter. It's counter-gravitational. You're taking the water from the depths of the ground and you're defying gravity and you're bringing the water up. And that's the man gets a sense of conquest out of that. He gets a sense of fulfillment out of that. Whereas for the woman, the sense of fulfillment is from feeding the flock. To have the women do the uplifting of the water and the men feeding the flock is a reversal of role that satisfies, that nourishes neither. That's what's important. And when we're told Paro tortured the Jewish people, what did he do? What was the torture? He gave men do women's work and women do men's work. That's the torture. Why is it torture? It's because you've got all the disadvantage of the work with none of the nourishment. If people do work that they are suited to, that they are designed for, that they're designed for not only on a physical level, but they're designed for on an emotional and a spiritual level as well, then the work nourishes. If a person is doing work that they're not designed for on every level, the work drains, the work destroys. And Moshe was concerned about what was happening here, that there was a diminishment of both men and women in the kind of work that they're doing. And that's the perceptiveness of Moshe. Moshe's got his own problems. He's running away from a murder charge. The police are out for him. He's fled to somewhere where he's been raised as a prince. He's never had to fend for himself. And here he is in a foreign land with nothing, absolutely nothing. Doesn't speak the language, doesn't know a soul, and has no money. And he's sitting at a well. And he's sitting there, and he's busy noticing the way the men and the women are relating to one another, what kind of society this is, and he's busy analyzing it, and he intervenes. And it doesn't matter that I'm a foreigner. This is not right, and he intervenes. Doesn't know these people from a bar, so. And then we're told, by Yoshi'en, and he saved them. Now, there are two words for saving. The one word is Hoshia, and the other is? Another word for saving? Have you heard of the Hatzolah? Have you heard of the New Yorker? And they don't have it here, do they? They don't have a Jewish Red Cross here, a Jewish 911. In some communities, some large Jewish communities, they have a Jewish 911. And that's called Hatzolah usually, Hatzalah. So Hatzlacha is different. Hatzlacha is success, and Hatzalah is to save, Hatzul. And the Medrash talks about the difference between those two words and says that the word here is not Vayatzi, it doesn't save them. Saving, Hatzul, is to save somebody from adversity. Lahoshia is to save them from death, save them from something much more serious. So Rabbi Yossi Agdidi says here, so what was the big saving? He watered their sheep for them. He saved them a day's work. What's the big thing? Hoshia, to use a word like Hoshia, where did you save them from? Says Rabbi Yossi Agdidi, Dovah shel gilui aroyos ba'olas esimahim. When it says that they were molesting them, there was an intended rape. This wasn't just that they were playing around, and he saved them from rape. Or the other view is, and the Medrash works out why that is the implication here. They threw them into the water, and Moshe actually went into the well and saved each one of the girls and pulled them out of the water. And so in both cases he was saving them from something drastic. They come to Reuel, and he says, why did you come so quickly? They say, Ish Mitzri Hitzilanam Yadari, an Egyptian man saved us. Ask the Medrash, Bechi Mitzri Haya Moshe? That's a bit of an odd thing to say. Surely they could see that this was not an Egyptian man. Moshe Rabbeinu being mistaken for an Egyptian man. Ela Levusho Mitzri Vahu Ivri. He was dressed like an Egyptian, although he was a Jew. So they thought he was an Egyptian. Now this is interesting, although there is later, much later on, there is talk of Moshe being punished for being mistaken for an Egyptian. There is, on the other hand, there is, it's interesting to see that he was dressed like an Egyptian. And we've often said that that Jewish clothing has traditionally been not different clothing from the society in which you operate, but the clothing of the highest social strata of the society in which you operate. So what would distinguish a Jew is that even the ordinary person would dress like a nobleman. That was Jewish clothing. In this case, he's dressed like an Egyptian, probably like an ordinary Egyptian. They mistake him, and Moshe is held to some degree accountable for that mistake, that they should have been able to see that he was a Jew. But there's another reason altogether they say that he's an Egyptian, and that the Egyptian man saved us. The Midrash gives a wonderful story that we use often, and that is Moshel. You can compare this to Echad Shonashocha Ha'orod, a man is bitten by a scorpion. And he goes to bathe himself, bathe his feet in the water. He puts his feet in the river. And while he's bathing his foot, he sees a baby drowning in the water. He stretches out his hand and he saves the baby and brings the baby safely back. The child says to him, thank you, because if it weren't for you, I would be dead. He says to the child, don't thank me, I didn't save you. It's the scorpion that I was running away from that saved you, because if it weren't for the scorpion, I wouldn't have been here. Kach Omru Bonos Yisrael Moshe, so the daughters of Yisrael also said to Moshe, thank you for saving us from the shepherds. Amalei Moshe said, it's not I, Oysu Mitzri Shehoragti Hu Yitzilechem, it's actually the Egyptian that I killed that saved you, because I should have been safely in Pharaoh's palace, I shouldn't even been here. The only reason I'm here is because I killed the Egyptian, so he's the guy you should be thanking. They told the father the story. There was an Egyptian man, and that caused this Moshe to be running away from Midian. And it's really because of that Egyptian man that we got saved. Now, is that normal? So what are you supposed to send a thank you card to the scorpion? Are you supposed to write the thank you to the family of the Egyptian man and say, your late father who was murdered by this criminal Moshe, thank you, you don't know what a wonderful thing it was, because the criminal had to run away from the police, and while he was running away from the police, he saved my child. So the death of your father or brother or whatever it is saved my child. Is that what it means? And why do they repeat it to the father? Why is it so significant that the Torah reports it as well? What's it teaching us? That in when it comes to appreciation, you've got to track back. It's not just the conduit, but it's actually the originator that you've got to try and find out. There's a conduit, and the conduit is important. You thank the conduit too, but there's an originator. It's like you send your child to take a gift to somebody, and they write a thank you letter to your child, and the child's the messenger. It's like the postman brings you a gift, so you say thank you to the postman, and you thank the postman as well, the postperson, whatever they were. One now calls postman. Are they still called postman? No. Mail carrier. Sorry. Mail carrier. So, are fathers still called fathers and mothers mothers? Or are they just called parental or parental providers or something? Yeah. You don't thank the mailman. You thank the mailman for delivering the mail, but he didn't give you the gift. You check who gave you the gift, and that's where you go to find it out. Now, if one doesn't go through that process in one's mind, you never get to God. And Moshe's point is when they said thank you to him, he was teaching them a lesson in theology and religion, not just in morality, because Hakoros Hatov is the link. Hakoros Hatov, indebtedness, is the link between morality and religion. If you take that quality out, then religion and morality have no connection. Then God becomes a service, it becomes a dogma, and morality becomes humanity. And they're two different areas. The only thing that creates that link is tracking gratitude down to the original source, which is why the mitzvah of honoring a parent is on the God side of the Ten Commandments, because that's the beginning of the process. Honoring a parent means that in everything you have during your life, you track back to the parents. So you think of something clever and you say, thank goodness my parents gave me a decent education, or encouraged me to have a decent education, or anything. But the honoring a parent means that in everything you do, you track something back and say, I had good parents, or even I didn't have good parents. They gave me life. They brought me here. Whatever good happens, that you track it back. Once you track it back to your parents, it's natural to go a step further and to track it back to God. But if you take that, the process of tracking HaKoros HaTov back to its origin, if you take that out of the moral system, then there's no connection between religion and morality. And that's what Moshe teaches them. And they're so impressed with this that they go back and teach their fathers. And the father then says, in that case, why didn't you invite him for a meal? Now, isn't that a bit odd? A meal? Is that how you say thank you? Give him some food? It wouldn't even be kosher food. What are you going to give him?
But the father had been studying, had been learning.
Well, he just got to the point of rejecting idolatry. That's all he'd done. He didn't know anything about God, yet he just knew idolatry was wrong. That wasn't the root. And of course, the reason that this all links in, the reason idolatry is wrong, is because you cannot track your goodness back to your idol. That doesn't work. So idolatry then means the creation of a religion that doesn't link into your moral system, that is separated from your moral system, because you can't track it back there. So he realizes this is not what it's about. Moshe comes and teaches them religion, God, without mentioning God's name, out of their own life experience. Imagine, I could imagine today, Moshe sitting at Yisra's table on Friday night and saying to them this lesson. You know, when you thanked me at the well, it wasn't really me you should have thanked. I'll tell you the story. I was a prince in Egypt, and this man was killing a Jew, hitting a Jew. I killed the Egyptian. Pharaoh heard, he sent the police after me, I ran, and that's how I happened to be there at that time. That's the story. And I could hear, if it was today, Yisra saying a few minutes later, or a little bit further into the meal, anybody got it about Torah? Isn't that so?
That was the departure.
Absolutely, but he didn't link it into the Fedra. Oy vey, terrible thing. And he didn't talk about God six times, and the Rebbeinu Shalom, and Emir Sashem. But look at that he penetrates the essence of the uniqueness of the Torah, of the complete denunciation of idolatry. The entire thing is there. And can you not imagine it today? Somebody say, "After do anybody got a Dvar Torah?" This is the Dvar Torah out of life. Just learn it. It doesn't have to be quoted from somewhere. You use your knowledge of the Torah to interpret life, but then use life to get somebody else to think, because you'll get them thinking about life much quicker than you'll get them thinking about a principle that you're imposing. The natural process is now for them to say, but how did all that happen? Was that just coincidence that you happened to be there at that time, or is there some mastermind? Right, now you can start discussing. But until you even get to that question, there's no point in discussing that. So that's what Moshe says. The father says, bring him home for a meal. Meta says he doesn't mean a meal. Nobody has a full time out here, do you know? We've all just got short. The Medrash says, "Ein achilat lechem ha'amur kan elo isho." Food here means a woman. To come and eat bread, that's not what he means. What he meant is, "Shemo yiso achas mechem." This is an unbelievable marriage opportunity. Why did you leave the man out there? Bring him home. And the Medrash proves it from the use of the term in other places, that a subtle, dignified word for a relationship is lechem, talking about a woman as the bread, the bread that he eats. A few interesting things here. Firstly, the fact that he saw it as such, and he didn't say that there's a marriage opportunity here, why don't you go out with him on Saturday night? He said, there's a marriage opportunity, why didn't you bring him home? Let him see you in your environment. Let him see how you live. Let him see your sisters. Let him see your parents. Let him see the whole operation. That could bring him in. Not you go out. That's how completely different the value systems are. But also important is why it's referred to as bread, why the Torah uses that image. And that there are three things that are called food. One is food, lechem. The other is Torah. And the third one is sex. Those are the three things. And why is that?
Well, the
because they nourish. They nourish. They're all nourishing. And there's an understanding of that. And he says that this is, that's your own. It's back to the woman as the sheep feeder rather than the water drawer. That there is a nourishment in that relationship, and that's what the focus needs to be on. That a man needs to be nourished on three different levels. He needs to be nourished physically. He needs to be nourished spiritually, in terms of wisdom, and he needs to be nourished emotionally and physically. And when there's an absence of any of those, they are the same symptoms as malnutrition. There's in slightly different forms. But a person who's used to a certain level of wisdom, when he's detached from that, a certain level of Torah, a person who's used to a certain level of emotional attachment, when he's detached from that, a person who's used to a certain amount of food and he becomes detached from that, it is the same kind of thing. And it's interesting that women then, as the nourishers, what is their role? So we said men draw the water and the women nourish. So food, physical, and what about her? Both intellectual and spiritual. How do they do that? By creating opportunities, by encouragement, by support. And if you look at all the cases where men have achieved greatness in Torah, it has never been with an adversarial wife, as far as that greatness is concerned. There's always needed to be, she's needed to participate in the support of him doing that and be active in that nourishment process. And she needs to realize that's nourishment. That a husband who comes back from a good shear, provided he's getting through a good shear, comes back a more energized husband. And the most stupid thing that women do, and women don't do a lot of stupid things, but one of the most stupid things is, don't go to a shear, I need you at home. That's like, don't have supper, I need you to work. Don't have breakfast, I need you to work. That's what don't go to a shear, I need you at home means. I'm having trouble with the children. Having trouble with the children, hire a nurse. Get your husband to a shear. He will be much more interesting to you and much more useful to you. If he's going, but I'm talking about a good shear, another shear where you just go and it comes back drained, or another shear. A shear where he comes back with his eyes sparkling. There's nothing more valuable to the wife than a husband who is turned on, than a husband who's alive, who's energetic, who's understood new things, who's seeing new things. And it's one of the most stupid things. And it's one of the things that rabbis have to compete with, is the wife who says, sorry, 6 o'clock is not a good time for a shear. 7 o'clock is not good, it's children's home. And it isn't, it's a hard time for a shear. But when is a good time for the shear? He's out to work at 7 o'clock in the morning. He's back at 6 o'clock. When is a good time? At 10 o'clock he must go out when the children are all finished with their homework and everything. Then he must go to a shear. It's complete suicide. A woman should say, when you come back from work, you've got half an hour. In another half an hour you can have a cup of tea or a cup of coffee in this country, or scotch or whatever you want to do. Put your feet up. Because in half an hour I'm throwing you out of here. You're going to a shear. Now your choice is what shear you want to go to, but I don't want to see you for 2 hours. Come 2 hours later, I'll be ready for you. The house will be ready. We'll do something else. Theoretically, I don't say it has to be that every night of the week, but that's what there needs to be, an understanding that the nourishment that a man gets from Torah, if it's a good Torah, is as valuable to the family as the nourishment he gets from food and from the emotional and sexual relationship, and that her role is in all of those. It can't be in by overdoing it just on the food area. That's just when he starts putting on weight, then you know it's out of balance. Cut down the food and nourish in other areas.
Are there not times in the family history when it's actually, if the woman's emotional or mental or physical health is, if everything is falling apart, when all the children are very little, is it not possible that maybe at that time you can have pressure on the family and they say, well, I can't do this now, even though it would nourish me, I need to do this year, next year when my children are little.
I wouldn't say that there are no exceptions to it. Obviously there are times when a family is in distress and he just needs to be around there. It needs to be. Well, then one should question you know what? One should question whether one should have a lot of little children. If that requires the demise of the husband's spiritual progress and intellect, then I would like to know, on what right has the family got to be so prolific in its production of children? And that's, and I'm not talking about any specific family. I'm just talking about there is such a belief of, you know, children, we are contraception, that's out of the question. I just have these 10 little children running around. What about my husband? He stays at home because now I need a husband. Now, 1 second, just think a little bit. On what right have you got to commit spiritual suicide because you think there's only one mitzvah in the Torah, and that's to have children? The mitzvah of becoming a Talmid Chacham is more important than the mitzvah of having children. Rabbi Akiva went away for 24 years, didn't have children during those 24 years, he studied. So my answer is no, that doesn't come first. Sometimes we get ourselves into a mess, and yes, you have to be there to sort it out. And then there are other ways of doing it. Then the husband says, I'll work a little harder, be a little bit more creative in business, and we'll hire help. We'll hire medical help, we'll hire physical help, we'll do what we need to do. We'll manage without a second motor car, we'll cut out that annual holiday, we'll hire help. But I'm not giving up my learning. And the whole value system of the first thing to go is the man's learning, and then we wonder why things get the way they do, because the man isn't developing, he isn't today. And then the woman finally, the children get taken care of, and now the woman gets going, and she's got a new life ahead of her, and she's got time, and she starts studying, and she starts building a business. By that time, he's exhausted. All he's done now for 15 years is work for a living with no input. Work is not the input, and he's had no time to learn and to grow himself. And he's got to carry on earning the living now. So he's finished. He's a washed out rag. And then they wonder why the families get into these situations. So no, a lot of thought needs to go into that. Okay.
Did you say that the word lechem then referred to those three things?
Yes. Torah, physical marital relationship, and food. I'll be away next
week. Share next week?
Oh, you can have a share. I just won't be able to give it.
Oh, no. I mean, still
share. Sure. Is at this moment, they still is a share. If it changes,
or 2 weeks
from today,
it's going to share. If it changes, then we'll let you know.
2 weeks from today. And then the Monday share is not next week, but
that's the following week, correct? Yeah. Monday the 31st, yeah.
Yeah, well, I remember 9 years ago when your brother was taking us through. I remember very clearly when we were at the Parsha, and he asked about that line about when Charles started, what is your invited in? He said, can you imagine a man who has 7 daughters to marry off? He does, and he sees this one eligible guy. He says, wait, go get him.
It's not just a question of eligible, it's a man who can bring that kind of Torah into the family. That's what he's just taking them through. Just look at the learning he's given them. In that one little interaction, a man like that you don't let go. He hadn't seen him, he didn't know what he looked like, he didn't ask Zipporah whether he was attractive. All he said is, a man like that you don't let go. A man like that you bring into the family.
Does this mean you know whether he chose Zipporah or Zipporah was given to him?
But clearly he seems to have chosen Zipporah because he didn't have time to get into it now, but that by Yoel where he swears to stay by Yisro is payment. Yisro said, you know, you had a grandfather called Yaakov, and he gave him some daughters. Lavan gave him some daughters, and he ran off with them. And I don't want to lose my daughters. And Moshe took an oath that he would stay in Midian. And when God sent him to Egypt, that's one of the reasons that he's hesitant in going. At the burning bush, there were two reasons why he was hesitant to go from the burning bush. The one was that he thought that it belonged to Aaron, and the other he'd promised Yisro that he would never leave Midian. And that he wanted to live by that he wanted.
Would that be without permission?
Yes. Well, so he wouldn't leave. He's promised that he wouldn't leave. Now, in order to leave, he's got to get permission.
Was it a good marriage?
And yeah, I think you're right. One Medrash says, in fact, that he wouldn't leave without permission. Or Rashi might even bring up that he wouldn't leave without his permission.
Do we know much about their marriage?
We know very little about their marriage. She will have an interaction with her next time. She's quite a forceful woman. And we know that he... Sorry?
She's crucified her.
Yeah, that's quite an interesting interaction. She challenges him quite sharply, and then we know, of course, they were separated at the time of Sinai and thereafter, and that was the whole thing with Miriam. Miriam was unhappy about that.
What you said about the yeshiva, we had the opposite experience that our son came home and said, I know now that the only connection I have with Hashem is through you. So that really brought us closer together.
That's very wonderful.
He did. I mean, he was Joel before he became Yoel, but not much changed in the name.
Okay.
But sometimes, particularly the Baal Shuva, that will bring us closer. The yeshivas job is to make them closer to their parents.
Yeah, but it doesn't always work like that. It is their job, and when they do that, it's great, and very often it's the child that does that. It's an outstanding child, learns and does it that way. But very often it has the parents, don't you keep kosher, you can't eat at the parents' home anymore. There's very often a divisiveness which comes in, which is problematic. But it doesn't happen, that's right.
To get along better with their
wonderful. Then he had wonderful teachers. Yeah, then he had wonderful teachers. Yeah.